Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today.
How did Christianity come to Corinth in the first place? Although many times we are left speculating about how an ancient church got started, we have definitive knowledge about the Corinthian church from Luke, Paul's traveling companion. In what follows, we'll work through Acts chapter 18 to see how Paul initially founded the church in Corinth. We'll also take time to consider what life was like for Paul as a tent maker, how he broke from the synagogue, and how we date Paul's time there using the Gallio inscription from Delphi. Here now is episode 585, part 2 of our 1 Corinthians in Context class, Paul Founds the Church at Corinth.
Now that we've familiarized ourselves a little bit with the city of Corinth, we need to talk about how Christianity got started there. And we're going to do that in this session by looking at Acts chapter 18. Acts chapter 18, verse 1 says, "After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he found a Jew named Aquila from Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they worked together. By trade, they were tent makers. Every Sabbath, he would argue in the synagogue and would try to convince Jews and Greeks." This little paragraph has so much helpful information. There's so much going on here. First, we encounter Paul. Paul's important. Paul was Jewish, but he did not grow up in Judea. He grew up in Tarsus, which is a city in Cilicia, up north from Jerusalem, a significant distance north. He grew up in the diaspora. The diaspora is what you call Jewish people who live outside the land of Israel. So Paul was not a normal person. Paul is very zealous, very enthusiastic, very passionate about his faith his whole life, as far as we could tell. We don't know a Paul that's just kind of apathetic, like, whatever. Like, the Paul we encounter is a Paul that's, like, into it. He becomes a Pharisee. A Pharisee is somebody that's strictly trying to follow the Torah, the commandments of God given through Moses, right? That's a Pharisee. That's where Paul's coming from. When he found out about Christianity, he didn't like it. He thought it was wrong. He thought Jesus was not the Messiah, that these people were deceived and deceivers. And he heard that they were going up to Damascus, and he said, "I don't think so." And he went to the high priest, and he got permission, and he got a delegation of people together, and he went to travel to Damascus because he knew if Christianity got to Damascus, which is a major city in the province of Syria, to the north of Jerusalem, that Christianity would spread all over. He knew that. So he went there to stop it. On his way there, he had a visionary experience in which Jesus appeared to him and convinced him that he really is the Messiah and that Paul is wrong about the whole situation. And so Paul flips and becomes the greatest Christian missionary. So he was like the worst persecutor, and now he's the greatest missionary. That's Paul the Apostle in a nutshell. He goes on 3 major missionary trips. In his second missionary trip, he travels to 14 cities. Paul came from a city, Tarsus. He was born a Roman citizen. Paul is a city guy. He's sophisticated. He knows cities. He knows how things work. He does not go out to the countryside and talk to farmers. He goes to the cities, 14 cities on his second missionary trip. He traveled to Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. Now he comes to Corinth. And after that, he goes to Ephesus. These are all big name places that ancient people would know. So let's take a look at Acts 18 again, verse 1. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There, he found a Jew named Aquila from Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them. Paul gets to town. He doesn't know anybody. Paul's Jewish. He looks for other Jews. It makes sense, right? He finds these two Jews who had been kicked out of Rome, Aquila and Priscilla. And it says here very clearly it was because Claudius had ordered them to leave. Now, when it comes to somebody like Claudius, the Roman emperor, we know stuff about this guy. This is not a mysterious person. This is not somebody that does stuff and nobody notices. This is somebody who does stuff and the historians will write about it a century later, 2 centuries later. So we have quotes about this incident. Suetonius, the historian, he writes around 121 to 122 about the reign of Claudius. Claudius reigned between 41 and 54. Suetonius says, "Because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from the city." Crestus could be somebody's name. It could just be a Jewish person named Crestus that was causing trouble in the synagogue. And the people got in a big fight with each other, a lot of chaos or disturbing of the peace. And the emperor is just like, "Not in my town, get out of here," and kicked him out. That's one scenario. A more likely scenario is that this is a misspelling of Christus in Latin, is how they say Christ. So it's just an E for an I. Now, word to the wise, ancient people did not care about spelling. This is driven home to me every time I go to one of these ancient cities and look at their inscriptions, because even in this same inscription, they'll spell words differently. It doesn't surprise me that it would say Crestus instead of Christus. That is certainly another possibility. If that's the case, then it was Jews in Rome fighting over whether or not Jesus is the Christ that caused this disturbance, which is significant. This is even before Paul writes Romans. There's already Christians there, which makes sense. Why else would he write him a letter if there weren't already Christians there? Cassius Dio kind of pulls things in the opposite direction. He is writing in the early 3rd century. He says, "As for the Jews, who had again increased so greatly that by reason of their multitude, it would have been hard without raising a tumult to bar them from the city, he did not drive them out, but ordered them, while continuing their traditional mode of life, not to hold meetings." So we have two ancient sources that are talking about the same incident. In one, they're saying he expelled them all from the city. In the other one, they say he didn't expel them from the city. He just said they couldn't meet together. It's hard when it comes to historical stuff like this to like know exactly, like maybe Cassius Dio, he's writing 200 years later. Maybe he's a little off. Maybe Suetonius is. Anthony Thistleton puts it together this way. He says, talking about Aquila and Priscilla, "They were probably freed persons of Jewish origin who left Rome in AD 49 when the Emperor Claudius closed down a Roman synagogue because of continuous disturbances centering on the figure of Christ. They may well have been converted in Rome," converted to Christianity, "and then came directly to the Roman colony of Corinth to set up their small shop in which to sell leather craft among the commercial developments off the Lechium Road." I think this is a reasonable synthesis, where what happened was not that Claudius told every single Jewish person to leave the city of Rome, because there's probably just way too many. That was Cassius Dio's main point. But he did send some people out of the city, because we know Aquila and Priscilla got kicked out of the city, and they hook up with Paul. There's no mention of him converting them. He never preaches to them. It's like they're already believers. So either he converted them or they were already converted to Christianity. They might have been part of a synagogue in Rome that had already received some sort of a Christian missionary and had already started to make converts. And we know that when people start making converts to Christianity in Jewish synagogues in the first century, it causes problems pretty much every single time. It causes disturbances. So that's a reasonable way to take it. All right, let's talk about tent making. Acts chapter 18, verse 2. "Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they worked together. By trade, they were tent makers." When it comes to making money, or just getting money, in the ancient world, there are very few ways to do it. One is to receive contributions, offerings from other people. And we know Paul did this. Specifically, we know he did it with the church at Philippi, because we have the epistle to the Philippians, at the end of which he thanks them for giving him money. I mean, he dresses it up in really nice language, but like that's basically what it is. It's a thank you note saying, thanks for the money. I have enough, stop giving anymore, is basically what he says. So Paul does take contributions, and I'm sure that wasn't the only case either, but that was probably a little later in his ministry. At this point, this is still pretty early. He is not doing that. When it comes to Corinth, he writes an entire chapter on this very subject, 1 Corinthians 9, because the money situation is weird in this city, and he doesn't want to get enmeshed in it. So he was never going to take anything from the Corinthians. So if you're not going to take any money from them, your second option is to beg. There were a class of people called the Cynics. These are a group of philosophers who wore a philosophical robe, and they begged for money in the city of Corinth. It's a well-established thing. But Paul may have felt his message would be discredited if he's begging for money. Or maybe he'd be associated with these other guys that he doesn't want to be associated with because he believes very differently than they do. So he doesn't beg. Third option is to charge fees for his teaching. This is something that's totally standard in the ancient world. They're called sophists. These are philosophers and wise people that will charge a fee and they will teach you what they know. Paul doesn't want to do that. He makes a big deal of saying he didn't do that in 1 Corinthians. Which leads us to the last option, which is to work a trade. Which is what he did. He worked a trade. In Corinth, that's what he did. He worked. In Thessalonica before Corinth, that's what he did. He worked. And for whatever reason, we don't really know why, he was a tent maker. Which means he worked with leather, he worked with canvas, probably worked with linen. And there are many situations in which tents or awnings would be very useful in the ancient world. These are all applications that I found in ancient authors. This is not like me imagining, oh, what would it be like? No, this is like actual stuff that we can document from the first century. So one would be canvas cloths used as awnings in theaters. You're sitting in the theater, you don't want the sun on you. So they would extend cloth above you as a shade. Sailcloth awnings provided shade in the forum, this is the marketplace. Awnings used in inner courts of houses. Rich people lived in what's called villas. Villas have an interior court in them, at the center of which is an opening to the outside. And if the sun is coming in, you might want to have an awning or some sort of shade. So that was another use case. Some shops had linen awnings projected over the pavement. Linen pavilions were used at beaches. We have this today, right? Somebody shows up to the beach and they just set up a whole tent, you know, instead of just the umbrella. They just bring the whole tent. That was going on 2,000 years ago, too. Merchants at festivals used heavy canvas booths to sell their wares. And people slept in leather or canvas tents when crowds flocked to Corinth for the Isthmian Games every 2 years. You know what they didn't do with tents? Recreational camping. Didn't exist. Nobody would ever do that. Why would you go live primitively in the woods for a weekend? That'd just be totally weird. Like, unless you're like in the military and you like got to because you're in a camp and you're trying to fight a war, right? So our number one use case for tents didn't exist in their world. But I'm going to come back to the Isthmian Games later, especially once you get to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. But the Isthmian Games were like the Olympic Games. They happened every 2 years, and they were like as big as the Super Bowl is in America. I mean, like everybody wanted to go. Everybody wanted to watch it. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people would come in from all over to watch these athletes and also musicians and also poets compete against each other for the wreath. It's a celery wreath that you would win as opposed to like, we have like a golden medal necklace that we give, right? For them, it was a celery wreath in the Isthmian games, at least. All right, so making tents involved cutting leather, canvas, or linen, waterproofing the material with wax, sewing pieces together, selling these products to people, taking orders, doing repairs, repair work. Somebody with these skills can fix sandals, can fix wagon coverings, can do a lot of other things other than specifically tents. He would be doing whatever the need was. When it comes to the location, in the south, there is this big, beautiful forum. Well, guess what? It's so big, it's so beautiful, it's so important that you're probably not going to have a shop there, because it's surrounded by, on two sides, by major temples. So it's got a major temple right here. That's the Apollo Temple. And then we got another temple over here. And then all these guys on the west, those are actually little temples too. And then this right here, these buildings, administrative buildings. Just like in the downtown of many cities in America today, a lot of the buildings are administrative buildings, government buildings, or houses of worship. Not places where you would sell leather goods. Where are you going to do that? You're going to do it up here in the North Forum. In the North Forum, there's plenty of space, and it's surrounded by porticos on all sides. Here's another shot of the city of ancient Corinth. Here is the North Forum on the right side. And you can see it is a lovely place where they have these porticos. Porticos are just the best. I hope someday you'll be able to go check out a portico. They reconstructed one in Athens. It's so cool. So it's modern, but it's made to look the way it would in their times. So a portico is just a roof that's held up by columns for shade. It's just like the greatest idea ever. And so you have all your shops in there, and archaeologists have found 44 shops around a square. They're 13 feet tall by 13 feet deep, and the widths vary between 9 and 13 feet. You have cobblers repairing shoes. You have fullers who cleaned and thickened wool. You have carpenters who made or repaired furniture. You have smiths who worked with metal, pottery stores, meat shops, grocers where you buy grain or barley. This is the kind of place where you go to do any of that. Jerome Murphy O'Connor offers the following description, which is somewhat, it's based on the archaeological evidence, but it also, I think, uses a little imagination. But I think it's really helpful. He says, in the back of the shop, a series of stone or brick steps was continued by a wooden ladder to a loft lit by an unglazed window centered above the shop entrance. This is where the family that owned the business slept, cooked, and ate. A hired man, such as Paul, would have slept in the workroom. Each worker had a bench on which tools were laid out, such as straight and curved needles, an awl, a punch, pincers, half-moon knives, shears, and an edge shaver. They worked seated in leather aprons stained by the wax they used both to roll the flax thread and to protect the hides. So just try to get yourself in the mindset here. Paul finds Priscilla and Aquila, and he lives with them, he works with them, he lives with them. That's how they did it back in those days. And so they would have a loft, so they would be in the top, and then he could stay in the bottom, at least for a little while. During the day, he's sewing. He's sewing together canvas, he's sewing together leather, he's cutting, he's working with the materials, putting wax on it for waterproofing, that sort of thing. This is what the man of God did in the city of Corinth when he arrived. And it was fantastic for evangelism. Paul could tell the message about Jesus to the customers. I bet if they came to his shop, they heard about Jesus. On either side of his shop, there's two other shops, and a lot of times they'd have a window or a door so they could talk to each other without having to leave and go out. So I bet he had an opportunity to speak to those people. After you've been working so many hours, you want to go get some food. You walk around to the other shops. Oh, there's a guy over there selling salted fish. Let's talk to him. Buy some salted fish. Paul's working in the trades. This guy's working in the trades. They see eye to eye. You know what I mean? Like, you could just imagine the scenarios in which it was natural for Paul to do evangelism, especially when you consider the fact that he had a compelling personality and he was completely sold out. He had a strong testimony. I hated Christians. I saw Jesus. I am a Christian. What? He had a strong, powerful testimony, and I bet he told it over and over again. He was well-educated, which is weird for a tradesman. He was well-educated, well-traveled, even weirder, and well-spoken. So he knew how to use the Greek. We see this in his epistle. Like, he knows the Greek language. He's good with it. He's not an amateur. Like, he's at home with it. The tent shop could even serve as a meeting place as just a few Christians start to gather, at least initially. There's not a lot of space in there. It's 13 by 13 by maybe 13 if you had a big one. And then you have a loft in there. So, you know, we're not talking about a lot of space, but you could fit a few people. You could have a Christian, what we would call a Bible study or a fellowship, or deliver a message, a testimony, whatever they were doing. And that was all good until you finally made the convert of a wealthy person. Once you get a wealthy person, that wealthy person has a house, a villa. And villas have courtyards where you can have meetings with lots of people, dozens of people. And so we see how this whole progression could work. And once Paul makes converts of a wealthy person, a person of that higher class, then that person can introduce him to others who are also wealthy. Paul can preach to them too, right? And he's doing all of it. He's got poor people and rich people in the church. We know that from reading the epistle. Still, tent making work was tedious. The hours were long and the pay was little. I don't want to romanticize it too much for you. It's hard work. Here's a description from Lucian of Samosata, writing around the year 160. He says, "Their trades, however, were petty, laborious, and barely able to supply them with just enough. All the men in the workshops, toiling and moiling from morning till night, doubled over their tasks, they merely eke out a bare existence from such wage earning." So you had to work many, many hours, and you just made a little bit of money, and that little bit of money was just what you needed to survive. That's what life was like for most people in the city of Corinth. Maybe 10% were super wealthy, and everyone else is kind of in the poor category. Bread would be limited to barley for most, and the only meat was salted fish. Paul comments on his work twice in the New Testament, both in Thessalonians. He says in 1 Thessalonians 2:9, he had been to Thessaloniki prior to coming to Corinth. He says, "You remember our labor and toil, brothers and sisters. We worked night and day so that we might not burden any of you while we proclaimed to you the gospel of God." You get the impression from that it was not like fun, enjoyable. Man, my job's really satisfying my soul. He says, no, it's labor and toil and day and night. And he says in 2 Thessalonians 3:7, "For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us. We were not idle when we were with you. We did not eat anyone's bread without paying for it, but with toil and labor we worked night and day so that we might not burden any of you." Work was hard. And here's something that many of us don't think about. Work was a major part of Paul's life. I mean, yeah, he's speaking the gospel as he's able to, but most of those hours he's bent over with a needle in his hand. But he also took a day off to rest. And on that day, he went to the synagogue and he preached to the other Jewish people in the city of Corinth. And that's where we pick it up in verse 4 of Acts chapter 18. "Every Sabbath, he would argue in the synagogue and would try to convince Jews and Greeks." That sounds about right. "When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with proclaiming the word, testifying to the Jews that the Messiah was Jesus. When they opposed and reviled him, in protest, he shook the dust from his clothes and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Then he left the synagogue and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the official of the synagogue, became a believer in the Lord, together with all his household, and many of the Corinthians who heard Paul became believers and were baptized. I try to help you feel the heat a little bit. You feel the heat when you read this? Your blood be on your own heads. It doesn't say they disagree with them. It says they reviled him and opposed him. I mean, this was acrimonious. There was a sharp conflict over whether or not Paul is legit and whether or not Jesus really is the Jewish Messiah. They said, "No, we don't believe this," and they cast him out. He went next door. The guy next door believed. It's interesting. The guy next door, it says he's a worshiper of God. That's a technical term that Luke uses in the book of Acts in particular to talk about a Gentile person who went to synagogue but had not converted to Judaism. So as somebody who is worshiping the God of the Jews but wasn't Jewish and didn't necessarily plan on becoming Jewish, just was interested. And so Paul comes into town and he preaches to these people and he says to them, you know, you can become a child of God. You don't need to get circumcised. You just got to believe in Jesus. How could you resist that message? Like, sign me up! You know, like, I could be a full member of the people of God, and I don't need to keep the law of the Jewish people, but yeah, I get the God of the Jewish people? That's an offer I can't refuse. And yet, these people were often people that the Jewish synagogue depended on financially and for protection within the city, and Paul is kind of pulling them into this new thing that they don't like called Christianity. Then he picked up Crispus. Crispus is a big deal, brother Crispus. And it says he's the official of the synagogue. Okay, that's all one Greek word. And it's a title that it could mean that he was a leader in the synagogue, but based on inscriptions that we've found with this title on it, it's more likely that it refers to somebody who had made a big donation to the synagogue. And so it was a title that you would give to somebody who had given financially. Again, if you're the Jewish synagogue, do you want Crispus, a major donor, going with Paul in this weird new religion that you don't want anything to do with? No, you don't. You can see why they would be so upset with Paul as he is evangelizing. And we also see this same term, official of the synagogue, in verse 17, applied to Sosthenes. We'll get to him in a minute. Let's talk about the next thing that happens. Acts 18, verse 9. One night the Lord said to Paul in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but speak and do not be silent, for I am with you. And no one will lay a hand on you to harm you, for there are many in this city who are my people." He stayed there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. But when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal. They said, "This man is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law." That's their accusation. Verse 14, just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of crime or serious villainy, I would be justified in accepting the complaint of you Jews. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I do not wish to be a judge of these matters." I'm trying to give him a little bit of snobbery there. You know, Gallio is a top-notch guy. He's important. He doesn't want to be bothered. Verse 16, and he dismissed them from the tribunal. Then all of them seized Sosthenes, poor dude, he's just in the wrong spot, I guess, and they beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of these things. This guy, Sosthenes, who got his butt whooped that day, he's a co-author of 1 Corinthians with Paul. It's from Paul and Sosthenes. This guy. And notice it also says that he is the official of the synagogue too, which means he's probably a donor as well. There's a lot going on here. I'm going to be as brief as I can be. Here's a picture I took of the rostra, the spot where this happened with Gallio. We have it. It exists. It's in Corinth. Gallio would be on top of this platform looking down. You can imagine a crowd could get underneath there and they could do whatever, and Gallio would just be like, yeah, whatever, you know, go ahead and beat up this guy, who cares, right? Like, because he's up on that elevated platform. Gallio is somebody that's very well known in the ancient world. His real name is Lucius Junius Gallio, born about 5 BC, dies around 65 AD. His brother is super famous. His brother is named Seneca, was a Stoic philosopher. 9 of his works have survived. There are people today that are reading Seneca. It's still very much in print if you go to any books, major bookstore. Emperor Claudius appointed Gallio proconsul. Proconsul is a 1-year term. He's a proconsul of the province of Achaia. That's the whole region around Corinth. But as the proconsul, he would be living in Corinth for that year, and he would be hearing cases and deciding on judicial matters, just like we read about in Acts 18. He only served part of the year. The plot thickens. Gallio only served part of the year and then left. He didn't like Greece. This is Seneca, his brother. He says, "All I could say was what my mentor Gallio had said when he was on the point of starting to have a fever in Greece. He immediately boarded a ship and kept insisting that his sickness was due to the location and not to his body." Murphy O'Connor writes, "It is natural to assume that Gallio took a dislike to Achaia and used a minor illness as an excuse to leave his post. Such an unreasoning aversion to a place is normally the result of a first impression. It may intensify with the passage of time, but it does not usually begin late. If this assessment is correct, it is unlikely that Gallio remained in Achaia more than 4 months, from June to September." This is just so incredibly important for understanding when these things happened, because this guy's only there for 4 months. We know Paul's there. Paul comes before him in a trial, kind of like a mock trial. He dismisses it. Okay, let me just fill in the rest of the detective case for you. Emperor Claudius famously wrote a letter to the city of Delphi. Delphi is not near Corinth, but it is in Greece, right? So he writes a letter to the people of Delphi. And in that letter, he mentions that Gallio was the proconsul. And from this letter, we can date when Gallio was the proconsul. If we can date that, we can date when Paul was in Corinth. And then we can date everything else either side of that in Paul's chronology based on this one piece of information. But it's crazy, because what does Delphi have to do with Corinth? Nothing. Why is this letter in Delphi? Delphi, let me just show you a couple pictures. Delphi is an incredibly beautiful place. This is a shot looking down from the city of Delphi into the valley. It's a mountainous region, fairly inaccessible. However, it's very important in ancient times because Delphi had the ancient Pythian Apollo Temple. And the Apollo Temple is where there was an oracle. If you've heard of the Oracle of Delphi, this is where it happened. And so cities from all over and people from all over and pilgrims would come to this city to hear a message from the gods. And so Delphi was very significant in Greek history, and the Romans were curious about it, and they were interested in it. And the emperor, Claudius, is like, hey, how's it going to Delphi? Kind of like curious about it. What happens is Gallio leaves Corinth. He goes to Delphi. He checks on it. He notices that there's like no people there. The city has shrunk to like nothing. And he goes back to Rome and he tells Claudius, he's like, oh, by the way, I stopped at Delphi and there's like no people there. You better do something or else the city's going to die. So Claudius writes a letter to the people in Delphi and says to them, I was talking to Gallio and I want to help you guys expand your population. Now, look at the this is just crazy. So, in 1905, a guy named Borget discovers 4 fragments of an inscription. In 1913, another archaeologist named Brossac added 3 more to the same inscription. In 1967, Plassar added 2 more. And in 1970, all 9 fragments were published. Here's a picture I took of the 9 fragments. This is not readable. Right? Like, I know it's 9 fragments. Like, whoa, look at all, there's all 9, yeah. There's more empty space than letters. You notice that, right? This is a shot I took in the Delphi Museum. It's at the very end. Very easy to miss this exhibit. I actually missed it the first time through. I had to go through the museum the second time until I found this. Because inscriptions so often follow the same pattern, professional epigraphers, people that do this for a living, could fill in most of the rest of this document. And this is what they did. They filled in the rest of the document. And they just infer, oh, this is a formula, it typically says this. And so here's an English translation. Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, invested with the tribunician power for the 12th time, acclaimed the imperator for the 26th time, father of the fatherland, sends greetings to, For a long time have I been not only well disposed toward the city of Delphi, but also solicitous for its prosperity, and I have always guarded the cult of the Pythian Apollo. But now, since it is said to be destitute of citizens, as L. Junius Gallio, my friend and proconsul, recently reported to me, and it goes on from there. This is how we got it. It's just like barely had enough, and then this is totally common knowledge today for anyone that does work on Corinthians, that we date it by Gallio and we have this nailed down because of this document. But I just think it's so cool to see the story of how that happens. The letter calls Gallio proconsul. We date the letter to the year of 52, which means that Gallio was proconsul from 51 to 52. Paul was there in 51. End of story. Verse 18. After staying there for a considerable time, Paul said farewell to the brothers and sisters and sailed for Syria, accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. So he took them with them. At Kenchreae, he had his hair cut, for he was under a vow. When they reached Ephesus, he left them, Priscilla and Aquila, there. But first he himself went into the synagogue and had a discussion with the Jews. He was always doing that, huh? So Paul left Corinth through the eastern port, Kenchreae, and he left to Ephesus. While in Ephesus, he was in Ephesus for a short time. He made the rest of his trip all the way back to Jerusalem and then started a third missionary trip. On his third missionary trip, he comes all the way back to Ephesus. Meanwhile, other things have happened with Corinth, and he's in Ephesus and he hears about what's going on in Corinth. Now, I don't want to overwhelm you with details, but I do want to give you a timeline so you can see a sequence of events, which I think will help you understand how 1 Corinthians as a letter works. Okay, so here's a brief timeline. In the year 51, that's all this Gallio stuff I was going through with the inscriptions. That's how we know it's 51. Paul visited Corinth when Gallio was proconsul. And then after that, Paul left Corinth. He went all the way back to Jerusalem and Antioch. Then he came back to Ephesus. In the meanwhile, Apollos visited Corinth. We read about that in the Bible. Then Apollos comes back to Ephesus. Then Paul, like I said, went on the second missionary trip, ended up in Ephesus, where he stayed for 2+ years. Ephesus is very close to Corinth by boat. And so he's hearing about the stuff happening in Corinth. In the year 53, Paul wrote a lost letter to the Corinthians. We don't know what it says other than it was advocating sexual purity. He refers to a previous letter in 1 Corinthians 5:9. In the year 54, Chloe, who we don't know anything about, but a lady named Chloe, an important person, sent some people who brought, they could be employees or slaves of hers, who brought a negative report about the Corinthians to Paul in Ephesus. In 54, Paul sent Timothy to Corinth to teach them how to follow in his ways, is how he puts it. That's 1 Corinthians 4:17. 54, also, a delegation arrives in Ephesus from Corinth with Stephanas, Fortunatus, and Achaicus, who have a letter with them from the church at Corinth that Paul receives. And it has questions in it. Questions that the Corinthian Christians want to hear Paul's answers to. And then in 54, Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. He wrote 1 Corinthians based on his experience of visiting and founding the church, the report of Apollos, the report of Chloe's people, and the letter from the Corinthians. And so what he does is he puts the information that he prioritizes first, the bad stuff he heard from Chloe, and he addresses that, namely divisions in the church and sexual immorality. And then in chapter 7, he says, "Now as to what you wrote me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Here's what I say." And so then we start getting responses to the questions that they had asked him in the rest of the epistle. Okay, so we got our bearings a little bit, but I want to just list out, I'm not going to go into any detail, I just want to list out the 11 issues that 1 Corinthians addresses, because this kind of forms an outline, more or less. I'm going to add a couple more in here, but an outline of the different subjects we're going to address in this class. So these are in order in which they appear in 1 Corinthians. There's the issue of factions. They're fighting with each other. There's the issue of them approving sexual misbehavior. There's the issue of lawsuits between Christians. The issue of licentiousness. It's kind of a fancy word. It means just like doing whatever you want to do, regardless of if it's right or wrong. Specifically, using prostitutes is the issue that he addresses there. Then he has a whole chapter where he talks about Christian marriage and singleness and divorce. And he also then talks about food sacrificed to idols, gender distinctions in worship, schisms at communion, selfish spirit manifestations, and then some who disbelieved in the resurrection. And then the last chapter, he talks about the collection of their offerings, their financial contribution that he's going to bring to Jerusalem to the poor there. So these are all things that we're going to talk about later in this class, but I think for now, you know at least how Paul visited there to Corinth originally, how he worked, how he preached, how he faced incredibly difficult controversy and conflict. I mean, this guy got brought to court. Once Gallio got assigned and he showed up, the Jews said, "Hey, let's bring him to the proconsul. Let's finish this guy." I mean, really, a lot of stuff that he went through in this city, and yet Jesus gave him a vision. Very rare that Paul ever talks like this. There's another place in 2 Corinthians 12 where he talks about visions too, but very rare. And he says, "Jesus spoke to me, and he says, I've got many people in this city. You're good. Nobody's going to touch you." And he said, "All right, I'll be here for a while." Maybe he moved over to Crispus's house instead of staying in the workshop. Who knows, right? But he was there for 18 months. And then he goes back home. Now he's in Ephesus. He's in a different city. Things are happening. The word is spreading. Disciples are forming. He's got Priscilla and Aquila with him there in Ephesus. And he starts hearing all this information about Corinth. Oh, this is going on in Corinth. Oh, that's going on in Corinth. And he writes them 1 Corinthians to guide the church so that they would understand and live out Christianity effectively. So next time, we'll dive in and cover the first major issue Paul addresses as we continue through this class on 1 Corinthians.
Well, that brings this presentation to an end. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 585, Paul Founds the Church at Corinth, and leave your feedback there. Now, many of you know my first book, Kingdom Journey, got published a little over a year ago. It was a memoir of sorts, detailing my journey of discovering what the kingdom of God is, as well as how Christianity lost it and found it later. Anyhow, I have been occasionally asking for people to go to Amazon and rate or review the book, and I was just checking to see how that was going and came across a very negative review. Someone using the username CX tanked it, giving it 1 star. Anyhow, here's what he wrote. The author starts strong with the rare biblical presentation of the gospel as the coming kingdom of God, per Mark 1:14-15, etc. But the message of the whole book is undermined in the ending, Appendix 5, when the author, for some unknown reason, concludes that, quote, "millennial positions are not primary. Jesus did not say, seek first the millennium, but seek first the kingdom. He did not proclaim from town to town, "Repent, the millennium is at hand," but "Repent, the kingdom of God is at hand," end quote. This, even though previous to this, the author is right to say, quote, "The millennium is the first phase of the kingdom. It initiates the changes that will eventually result in a new heavens and earth in which righteousness dwells," end quote. Sad and confusing indeed. So this guy actually agreed with everything I put forward in the book. This is what is just blowing my mind right now. He tanked it with one star, and he actually agrees with everything I put forward in the book. He agrees that the kingdom is the gospel message. He agrees that the kingdom is coming on earth rather than us going to heaven. He agrees that the kingdom is our motivation for pursuing righteousness. He finds no fault with my historical investigation of the reasons why we lost the kingdom. He finds no fault with the historical investigation of the three movements that rediscovered the kingdom. He agrees with my position that the millennium begins when Christ returns and that it is the first phase of the kingdom. In other words, premillennialism. But he disagrees with my view of how important my belief that agrees with his belief is. He's upset enough with me, not regarding premillennialism, he's upset enough with me because I do not regard premillennialism as an essential doctrine that he felt the need to sink my rating on Amazon. And then someone else clicked the helpful button on this, which gives this guy's review credibility. Now, what does that tell you? Well, let me ask you this. What percentage of Christians do you think believe in going to heaven instead of the kingdom? What, 90%? 95%? This guy is one of the very few who is on my team. And he went out of his way to prevent people from getting a book that until Appendix 5, he can't find a single disagreement with. Ladies and gentlemen, don't be that dogmatic. Don't be that rigid. You reserve the right to believe whatever you like, but you don't need to have complete doctrinal uniformity to support someone's work. We need to get out of this all-or-nothing, zero-sum game mindset. I can support Christadelphians, even though I disagree with their views on the spiritual realm. I can support the Church of God, even though I disagree with their views on speaking in tongues. I can support Spirit and Truth, even though I disagree with their belief in dispensationalism. I can support the Christian Disciples Church, even though I disagree with them on, well, I don't know, but something surely I disagree with them on. But here's my point. We are a religious minority. We are excluded from evangelical publishers and institutions of higher learning, and instead of supporting one another, we bite and devour one another. We find someone we agree with on 99.9% and attack that 0.01% publicly. We need to do better. Let's cheer each other on rather than tear each other down. We can still disagree. That's fine, but we should still support each other as far as we can support each other on the things we agree about. Well, that's the end of my little rant here. I wonder what you think. Come on over to restitutio.org, find episode 585, and leave your thoughts there. Obviously, truth matters. Truth is important. I'm all about pursuing truth wherever it leads. That's the whole idea of the slogan, "The truth has nothing to fear," that I literally end every episode on, because I think we should relentlessly and courageously pursue truth wherever it leads. But that doesn't mean that I have to be a jerk to somebody that has a 0.01 disagreement with me. Well, that's enough for today. I hope you'll join us next week as we look at part 3 of the 1 Corinthians in Context class and consider the question of divisiveness in the church in Corinth in the first century. Seems like a fairly relevant subject for our next episode. So join me for that next week. If you'd like to support us, you can do that at restitutio.org. I'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.